As you can tell on the screen, we're going to begin this morning with an introduction to the book of Daniel. I feel bad that we're having to jump from introduction in Wednesday night class to introduction in Sunday morning class. Unfortunately, that was just the timing, the way that things went. But we're going to take a look at the introduction to the book of Daniel. There's a lot of controversy surrounding this book. In fact, among Revelation, Genesis, and a couple of others, you'll see why there's controversy surrounding the book of Daniel regarding several various issues. So we're going to try not to be as redundant as perhaps the Wednesday night class introduction has been. We're going to look at everything just once, although it is important to have that redundancy. We're going to look at these things just once, and you'll see various topics from the introduction manifesting themselves throughout the study of the book. But I really feel like an introduction is necessary to help set our contextual, historical tone before we actually delve into the text. And once we prepare ourselves in examining the book and the writing and some aspects of the writing of the book of Daniel, we will be fully equipped to delve right into the text and then begin a study of the book itself. Style of the class is going to be a little bit different than has been on our Wednesday night. We're not going to have an actual workbook. I'm going to do my best to provide questions. I recognize that some of those questions may be challenging, and I marked the ones that I thought were more challenging to be the thought questions. So don't feel bad if you weren't able to answer that to the degree that you wanted to be able to. My goal is that after we're done with our class, particularly the introduction, that you will then be able to answer the questions more completely. So if you're able to answer some of those, that's great. But that's kind of just a guideline to allow you to see what we're going to be looking at and to give you an idea of how the class is going to go. So if you weren't able to perfectly answer all of those questions, don't feel too bad about that. By the time the class is over, hopefully you'll be able to. Comments and questions are more than welcome and definitely appreciated. If at any point in time you'd like to ask a question about anything that's mentioned or you want to know more about something that I may have neglected to speak in as much detail about, feel free to let me know. Interrupt me if you want to, or raise your hand. I'll try my best to catch everyone, and we'll get all the questions answered that we can. Our questions that you did answer are going to be interspersed throughout the class itself. So from time to time, we'll pause and we'll answer a question. I'm not going to call on a specific individual. Just anybody that wants to answer the question and anyone that wants to add their answer to the question is more than welcome to whenever we stop for those questions. Okay, we're going to start off this morning looking at the historical background of the book of Daniel. You probably realize through the reading that was suggested from the questions that we're going to take a look at the historical background. So we'll just start with a question at this time as we open up our class. And if you grab one of those timelines, we're going to be following that. We'll take a few moments to read some of the passages. We're not going to read them all, but to read some of the passages and allow the Bible itself to unfold history for the events that lead up to Daniel, the book itself. Question one, what are some of the major events recorded in the Bible that lead up to the book of Daniel, where that should be Judah, where Judah has been taken captive in Babylon? What are some of the events that that you read about? Dave? Okay. Okay. Now what book are you talking about? Chapter 22 of 2 Kings? Okay, is that where Josiah kind of restores worship? Okay. So Josiah is, I don't think we're going to talk a little bit about Josiah this morning, but Josiah is really the last good king in Judah. So he, as Dave mentioned, restores worship, finds the book of the law, and makes an attempt to bring the people back to God. But after Josiah, the leadership for the nation of Judah just really goes downhill quickly. And what we're going to find out is the reason for Judah's captivity in Babylon is the wickedness of the kings, the wickedness of the nation, and some of the things that they've done. Any other significant events, and you can kind of pull from your timeline here.
That would be the single most important thing, is that the kingdom had turned against
God. Okay. And I'm wanting to say that it may have been Manasseh I believe Manasseh was the son of Hezekiah. Hezekiah also being a good king, but Manasseh was one of the absolute worst kings, probably the worst, most wicked king that Judah had. He was one, if you remember, that set up the altars in high places. He was the one who made his children pass, made his sons pass through the fire. I believe in worshiping the god Molech. So Manasseh was one of the worst kings of Judah. And I believe it was at that point in time that Judah's judgment was sealed. Their time in Babylon was sealed. And despite the fact that Josiah was righteous, judgment still came upon that people, but it was spared past Josiah's sake. So let's take a few moments to look at the history. We're going to probably spend a large part of our class looking at just the history leading up to the book of Daniel. And we'll have some maps that I hope everyone in the back is able to see that okay. But these are all of the major events that lead up to what happens in Daniel. What I found interesting in studying all of this is Daniel is a book of history, and a lot of the things that we're going to look at are going to be historical accounts of real world powers that were taking place thousands and thousands of years ago. And I find it interesting how the Bible corroborates history, or rather I should say history corroborates the Bible. That is, not only can we open up our Bible and read from, as we're going to do, 2 Kings and 2 Chronicles, various historical events that were taking place among the Jews, we can also see that history corroborates that as well and reinforces that. And I really found that interesting. So some of the things this morning we're going to look at regarding the historical background are going to be from the Bible, and some of them are solely going to be from history. But this is really where it all started, back in the time of 930 BC, and this is where the kingdom of Israel was divided. You know, previously, King David and King Solomon reigned over both Judah and Israel as a whole. They reigned over all 12 tribes. However, 930 BC, the nation of Israel was divided into what two parts? Okay, north and south. Who were the southern tribes? Do you remember? Okay, Judah and Benjamin were the southern tribes. And Rehoboam was king over that, Solomon's son. Jeroboam was king over the 10 northern tribes. And respectively, the northern tribes, the 10 tribes, are referred to as Israel, and the southern tribes, the 2 tribes, Judah and Benjamin, are referred to as Judah. So we see that about that time, Israel was divided, and both Israel and Judah then, for the next 150 years, have their respective kings, some over the north, some over the south, and we read about that through the book of 1 Kings and 2 Kings, 1 Chronicles and 2 Chronicles. Where really things start to take a turn, however, is in 721, and that's where the nation of Israel, the 10 northern tribes, are carried away into Assyrian captivity. Now, during this point in time in history, Assyria was the powerhouse of the world. That is, they were the nation that had the most power, the strongest army, and they possessed the most land, fiercest nation there was at that point in time. And because of Israel's idolatry, they, in turn, are taken into Assyrian captivity. Now, Israel is just about completely demolished. There really isn't going to be an Israel reestablished like we're going to see with the country of Judah. Israel's pretty much done at this point in time. God's wiped his hands with his people. We do read about in our New Testaments, the relevance of this in our New Testaments, the Samaritans are a product of the Assyrians and the Israelites that intermarried. And so their children, their offspring, were what we refer to as the Samaritans. And that's why the Jews hated the Samaritans, and there was such a distaste for them from the pure Jews, because they saw the Samaritans as somewhat of a half-breed, a half-Jew, because they'd intermingled and the bloodlines between the Assyrians and the Jews had become intermingled. So in 721, you've got northern Israel, those 10 northern tribes, falling to Assyria. So Judah's really all that remains, and on the map, the blue is the Syrian land, and Judah is all that remains of God's people at this point in time. Okay, in 627, you've got there the death of an Assyrian king by the name of Ashurbanipal. And this is when the Assyrian army is in its peak and in its strongest might, and Ashurbanipal is really the last strong king to arise that reigns over the Assyrians. And so he dies in 627, and the result of this really is political instability throughout the land. And this is really where Assyria's downfall begins to take place with the death of Ashurbanipal, because of the political instability that results from his death. In 626, this is really where you see Babylon begin to gain a foothold. they're going to rebel. They're going to throw off the reign of the Assyrians. King Nabopolassar becomes king of Babylonia, and Babylonia is the country. Babylon is the city where he names his capital, and you can see up there on the map the area of Babylonia, and he names his capital the city of Babylon, and that's going to be very reoccurring in the book of Daniel. 616, King Nabopolassar of Babylon is going to ally with Medea. Medea's up there to the north. He's going to ally with Medea, and he's going to essentially begin the rebel in earnest against the Assyrians. And he takes there, you see, to the east of Babylon, that little bitty city called Nippur. He begins his conquest there among the Assyrians. He takes that city of Nippur, and in turn, Medea goes and they take that city of Asher, which is a little bit north of Babylon. So that's really where the rebellion against the Assyrian Empire begins in earnest. In 612, and this is a very major event in the overthrow of the Assyrian reign, 612, you've got Babylonia and Medea taking the city of Nineveh. Now, Nineveh was the capital of the city of Babylon. And so it was a big deal whenever Babylon allied with Medea and then in turn took over the city of Nineveh, overthrew the city of Nineveh. So in turn, what Assyria did is they moved their capital west, since Nineveh had been overthrown, they moved their capital west to the city of Haran. And a couple years later, the Battle of Haran occurs, and the Assyrians, they rallied troops in that city, but they still lost the city. And so they moved their capital again west of Haran to Carchemish. And this is really where we'll begin picking up our account in the Bible, the historical account that the Bible gives us, because the capital of the Assyrians has been moved from Nineveh west to Haran. When Haran was lost, they moved once again west to the city of Carchemish. Let's tell you what, let's turn to 2 Chronicles 35. And as I was saying, the Bible corroborates history, and history corroborates the Bible. And this is where we really see the first historical account of the relevant history for the Babylonians mentioned in the Bible, and that's in 2 Chronicles chapter 35. Mr. Barker, would you mind reading those verses there for us, 2 Chronicles 35? Let's stop short of 27, though. If you'd stop at the end of verse 24, that kind of concludes the event that takes place there. Yes, sir. Okay, so remember just previously, both Babylon and Medea have made war against Assyria. They defeated the capital of Nineveh a few years ago. The capital of Assyria was moved to Haran, and then it was moved to Carchemish. And that's what we read about in 2 Chronicles 24, this battle of Carchemish. And if you notice there at the beginning of that in verse 20, Pharaoh Necho was going to go. And what had happened, the Egyptians had allied with the Assyrians, and the Medeans had allied with the Babylonians. So Pharaoh Necho, you know, Egypt's down there southwest of Jerusalem, and you've got that area there that's going to be Judah, and there's Jerusalem there. Egypt is down to the southwest. And so he's coming to help, Egypt is coming to help the Assyrian army, and what Pharaoh Necho's doing, he's trying to march his way up the coast there, the east coast of the Mediterranean Sea, and make his way up to Carchemish, where he can assist the Assyrian army. However, he has to cross through the land of Israel, and that's where he meets King Josiah at the Battle of Megiddo. And you may have read there that God had told Pharaoh Necho, you're to go up there, you're to make war at Carchemish. And he tells Josiah, God sent me here, don't get in my way, essentially. Josiah continues to oppose him there to prevent him from making his way up to help Assyria at Megiddo. And as a result of that, Josiah dies there in the Battle of Megiddo. So what's going to happen, Egypt's going to go ahead and they're going to march up to Carchemish to assist the Babylonians, or to assist the Assyrians there at Carchemish, where they were attempting to go whenever Josiah somewhat interrupted them. We won't look at this particular passage, but in 605, what's going to take place is that actual battle of Carchemish, and Jeremiah just very briefly mentions it in Jeremiah chapter 46 and verse 2. He refers to King Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonians, who defeat both Assyria and Egypt at the Battle of Carchemish. And so at this point in time, this is really the changing point for the overthrow of the Assyrian army. This is the point in time where they begin to go downhill. It was at the Battle of Carchemish where the Babylonians defeated both them and Egypt. 605 is a very relevant year as far as the historical events are taking place. It's in that year that Babylon defeats Assyria, and the army is severely weakened at this point in time. Also, we find, picking up in the book of 2 Kings, King Nabopolassar, actually it's King Nabopolassar's back in Babylon, King Nebuchadnezzar that we're going to read about in the book of Daniel, he is in control of the army. He's the one that defeated the Assyrians at the Battle of Carchemish. He marches down south, since he's already defeated Egypt as well at the Battle of Carchemish. He marches down south to take on Egypt once again. And passing through Jerusalem, what he does, and we won't turn over there and we won't read that, but it's King Jehoiakim who is king of Judah at this time after Josiah had died. And so Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian army, they march down south. They stop there at Jerusalem, and they essentially take all of the tributes that Assyria had, or that Egypt had previously had, and they force Judah and several of the other countries that were paying tribute to the Egyptians. They essentially take over them and somewhat overthrow them to a small degree. That happened in the same year that they defeated the Assyrians at the Battle of Carchemish. And that's where we go to Daniel chapter 1, and we find that Daniel and his friends, the first time Nebuchadnezzar passes through Jerusalem, that's where Daniel and his friends are then taken captive. And we'll study these passages more in detail. That's just up there for your reference. Daniel 1, he and his friends are taken back to Babylon to serve under King Nebuchadnezzar. So another very historical relevant event that's not mentioned in our Bibles. Remember, Nebuchadnezzar is the one leading the army. He's heading down to Egypt. His father is back in Babylon. But in 605, his father, Nabopolassar, dies. And so what Nebuchadnezzar has to do is he has to traverse his way all the way back to the city of Babylon to reclaim his throne. Because if he doesn't do that quickly, and if he doesn't act quickly, then someone else will then step up. So he hurries back home to reclaim his throne. And it's at this point in time that Assyria is essentially demolished. And for that matter, Egypt as well. They're never going to have the same power and influence that they did over the old world, as a result of having lost at the Battle of Carchemish. So pretty much all of Assyria is now under Babylonian control. So in 605, Nebuchadnezzar goes back to the city of Babylon. He reclaims the throne. So he's going to be king of Babylon whenever we pick up in the book of Daniel. And that's really the events that led to him being king. In 602, Jehoiakim, who you remember, he had been forced to pay tribute by King Nebuchadnezzar to the Babylonians. He rebels, since the Babylonian's king has died and Nebuchadnezzar's had to leave. He rebels, and you can go and you can read in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, 6 and 7, that as a result of that rebellion, he's then taken in bronze fetters all the way back to Babylonia. And I'm having trouble seeing the clock because of a glare. Y'all let me know whenever it's about 6:35, if you would. Otherwise, I'll just keep going. So Jehoiakim of Judah, king of Judah, rebels, and he's taken back to Babylon in 602. His son, Jehoiachin, doesn't do any better than his father does. He rebels against the Babylonians. And so what happens is Nebuchadnezzar goes back to Jerusalem. He dethrones Jehoiachin, and he makes Zedekiah king of Jerusalem. So king of Judah. So at this point in time, Jehoiakim and Jehoiachin have both been dethroned, and Zedekiah is appointed as king by King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. So Zedekiah is now the one that reigns there. And you can go and you can reference all of these historical passages and historical events throughout the lineage and the chronicles of the kings of Israel. So Zedekiah is made king, and you know how the story goes. Jehoiakim rebelled against Babylon captivity. Jehoiachin, his son, rebelled. And Zedekiah is going to reign for a few years, but just like those before him, he's going to rebel against Babylon as well. And 587 is really the destruction, if you want to the final destruction of Jerusalem. That's where King Nebuchadnezzar goes in with his Babylonian army, and Jerusalem itself falls, the temple is razed, and the temple is destroyed, and this is where the destruction in earnest takes place in 587. So that's actually the date that Babylon destroyed Jerusalem, and Judah was taken captive to the largest degree. And after that, I guess I didn't have that even up there. 1 year later, they appoint a little figurehead governor named Gedaliah, and he's assassinated by some of the zealots that are there in Jerusalem. And everybody else pretty much flees that area because they've all been taken to Babylon. The rest of them flee down into Egypt, and they stay in Egypt while Babylon remains in power. So that's kind of a historical event that sets us up to the book of Daniel. So we're going to take a few moments now to consider the background of the book, and we've got there our second question. What does the name Daniel mean? Okay, God is my judge. God is my judge. My judge is God. Both of those. So bear that in mind as we study throughout the book of Daniel and see if that name, because names under the Old Testament have more relevance than they do today. Today they're just really a means of us associating and distinguishing ourselves from anyone else. However, in the Old Testament and even in the New Testament, names were very significant. You were given a name in hope of accomplishing great things. And you even kind of find out in the Old Testament, names were somewhat associated with the character's personality. So, interesting to see and study names in the Old Testament. But keep Daniel's name in mind, God is my judge, my judge is God, either of those, and see if you can find out how that may manifest itself throughout the book. Alright, question 3. Cite in Scripture other men who share this name. Okay. Okay. And Abigail, we have an account of her, I think it's in the book of 1 Samuel, maybe 2 Samuel, where David marries her. She was the wife of Nabal. Nabal made a foolish mistake in crossing David, and as a result, he's really punished for his foolishness and his selfishness. And in turn, Abigail is a very wise woman, a woman of wisdom, great wisdom and beauty, and David in turn takes her as his wife. And Daniel was David's second son. Did you find anyone else in the Old Testament that shared that name? Okay. Okay. Yeah, he was of the lineage of Ithamar, who was the fourth youngest son of Aaron, and he was one of the ones that you just mentioned. He was one of the ones that signed this covenant that Nehemiah had produced. Okay, anyone else find any other mention of Daniel aside from this book? Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, right, El, like Elohim, El is the prefix there, El Shaddai, God Almighty. So El is the Hebrew prefix for God, so Daniel is God is my judge, or Daniel's God is my judge. I'll tell you what, let's look real quick as we consider question 4, Ezekiel chapter 14. Go ahead and turn your Bibles over there. Johnny just mentioned that Ezekiel refers to Daniel three times, I believe it is. Twice in Ezekiel chapter 14. Danny, would you read Ezekiel 14, verses 12 through 14 for us when you get over there, please? 14, 12 through 14. Okay, and question four, this is one of the ones that I thought might be a little more challenging than some of the others. Who is the Daniel that's mentioned in Ezekiel 14:14? Johnny, you've made it evident who you think that Daniel is. Do you think they're talking about the prophet Daniel? The Daniel that we have in our Bibles? Now, who's he mentioned alongside? Okay, and that's the problem that some people have in looking at this and saying, well, why is this, how can this be Daniel the prophet? Because when you look at the men that Ezekiel mentions, and the context of this passage is, Judah has seriously sinned against God, and you remember how back whenever God was debating on destroying Sodom, he's speaking to Abraham, he and Abraham are having this conversation, and he says, you know, for 10 righteous men in the city of Sodom, I'll spare that city. And so now what he's saying here, Israel's become so evil that even if, you know, Daniel, Job, and Noah were to be inhabitants in the city of the land of Judah, I wouldn't spare them. That's how evil Judah had become. Judah's judgment was going to be determined for sure. But the problem that some people have with this particular reference being Daniel the prophet was that you've got there Noah and Job, who were both men of righteousness many, 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 many years before Daniel the prophet would have come on the scene. Now, I think Johnny mentioned too that Daniel the prophet would have been a contemporary of Ezekiel. For that matter, he might have been a little bit younger than Ezekiel, maybe a little bit older. He would have prophesied while Ezekiel was prophesying. And so, I can understand that argument, them wanting to say, well, Daniel here is mentioned alongside men that were meant, that lived righteously thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. He really doesn't have a place among them. And so they disqualify that as being Daniel. Also, there's a minor spelling difference in the actual Hebrew that caused some to say, well, it's talking about a different Daniel, because the Daniel that's referenced in the book of Ezekiel is missing one vowel that Daniel the prophet uses whenever he spells. His name is recorded in his book. And so they say, well, since it's a different spelling, it must be a different individual. But I'm kind of with the ones that do agree. You know, for one, we don't have any historical or biblical account of a man, Daniel, who was a contemporary of Job and Noah during that patriarchal age. And also, what's under consideration here? The book of Daniel, but, you know, as Ezekiel's speaking, what he's saying is, you know, even if these righteous men, and he's talking about the righteousness of Daniel and Job and Noah, and it's the righteousness of these men that's under consideration. And so it's not really relevant if Daniel fits into the time frame of the previous. Rather, he's considering the righteousness of this man. So I personally believe that it's the prophet Daniel that he's talking about. Because as you're going to find out, what Molly mentioned to me before class, you know, Daniel was a very righteous man, a very godly man. And we're going to discover more about his character as we consider the book itself in more depth. Okay, Daniel the man, we'll take just a moment to speak about him. As I said, he was a contemporary prophet among Jeremiah and among the prophet Ezekiel. Jeremiah was living in the city of Jerusalem during his prophecy and during his ministry. And so he sees firsthand how terrible God's judgment is against the Jews. And I don't know if anyone's ever read the book of Lamentations or considered the book of Lamentations. Lamentations was written by Jeremiah because Jeremiah was there among the Jews and he saw how terrible God's judgment was among the city of Jerusalem. And so he records essentially this lamentation for God's people because he sees just how incredibly awful the things are that have been taking place. So Jeremiah prophesied a little bit before Daniel began his prophetic ministry. However, they were somewhat contemporaries to a certain degree. So Jeremiah was in Jerusalem during his time of prophesying. Daniel was off in the city of Babylon during his time of prophesying, and Ezekiel lived in Babylonia with the Jewish exiles. So those three men were active and had a prophetic time of activity during the Jewish captivity and enslavement in Babylon. But you've got their three different perspectives that's kind of interesting to consider. Jeremiah was in Jerusalem, Daniel was in Babylon, and Ezekiel was in Babylonia with the Jewish exiles. So we're not going to spend a lot of time talking about the authorship. We are going to spend a lot of our time next week, however, talking about the dating of the book, and you'll understand why that's incredibly relevant regarding the book of Daniel next week. But we're going to attribute the authorship to Daniel the prophet. The author speaks in first person on several occasions. Daniel 7:2, Daniel spoke, saying, "I saw in my vision by night, behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea." And he says again in Daniel 8:1, "In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared to me Daniel, after the one that appeared to me the first time." So, you consider that, and you consider Jesus references Daniel as the author of this particular prophecy, the abomination of desolation. But the fact that Jesus acknowledges him as such should really seal the deal in our mind when we consider the authorship. In Matthew chapter 24, 15 and 16, Daniel the prophet, when we get later into the book, is going to talk about the abomination of desolation. And Jesus, in speaking of this prophecy, attributes the abomination of desolation that was spoken of by Daniel the prophet. So Jesus kind of, for me, seals the deal in regard to who could be the potential author of this book. So we're not going to give a lot of time and consideration to that particular question. We'll pick up next week, however, as we're coming to a close for this particular session. We'll pick up next week looking at the date of the book of Daniel and spend some time looking at that because it's terribly relevant in regard to the understanding. Depending on whenever you believe this book to be written, it will change your interpretation and the meaning and the significance of the book very greatly.